A word by Romick is always pretty young, but we comforted, and I think that's part of what the work is about. So I look at it through the tradition that's attached to monumental sculpture. Monumental sculpture is traditionally attached with economical, political, religious display of power. But that's not the case at all here. The monumentality here plays a completely different role. It's not about saying that, you know, we have the biggest city or we won that battle. That's something that's completely different here. And I think that's important to keep that tradition in mind still, because it informs the work and it informs the way we look at the work. Because it's a big sculpture, we come to it with this assumption that it should tell us something big. It should tell us something historical. And I think it of course, it's not the case. So we're right away put off, put outside our assumption. So very quickly, for the people that haven't checked him out yet, Romick was born in 1958. He's an Australian sculptor and is working in the UK. And he began his career working on the Australian children's television program, Shaw's Neighbourhood. And he was the creative director. So what he did really is that he made, he voiced and operated puppets. So you see that he's coming from a make-believe background, which I think is interesting. He also worked in the film industry as a model maker and a puppeteer. And probably some of you here will know the film Labyrinth. And he was involved in that in that movie. And he moved to London to establish his own company, and his company was making photorealistic props and animatronics for the advertising industry. So they were very detailed objects, but he was dissatisfied by the fact that you couldn't look at them from all sides and keep that make-believe effect. You could only look at them because they were meant to be photographed, you see. So he was only making them so that you were able to look at them from one angle. So that's what pushed him to move to a more complete sculptural practice. It pushed him to actually move into the realm of the fine art and separate himself from the advertising industry. His big break really was in 1996 when he started collaborating with his mother-in-law, Paula Rego. And Rego introduced him to Charles Saatchi, who was immediately really, really impressed by his work, that really launched his career as a fine artist. He was included in the Sensation show. Sorry about the accent. Sensation. I say it now, probably. The Sensation show in London, and so that's really the start of a brilliant career. Since then, he went on to exhibit all over Europe, including at the Venice Biennale, in Japan, in North America, and Australia. He was even an associate artist at the National Gallery in London. So he's a very successful artist. He's done very well for himself. So that's why he's even more interesting, because here is an artist that's alive and successful for a 19th century art specialist. It's a rarity. So now Louis is going to talk to you a little bit about how that sculpture fits in the rest of his work.
Yeah, as far as the sculpture in relation to his wider body of work, one of the things about Ron Muir's work is its distinctiveness. You see one of his sculptures and you know immediately that it's one of his. The materials he's used in all of his sculptures are the same. Fiberglass, polyester resin, silicon, in some of the larger works, aluminium, horsehair and synthetic hair. As far as the other works in the show, I think that this one stands out because of its size, and it also has a really nice relationship to the work in the other room, in bed. I do really enjoy the way the work is set out in these gallery spaces. Both of them, their eyes are averted from the viewer. They're both looking away, can't sort of catch them. As far as the materials go and the distinctiveness of the materials he uses, as a sculptor, that's something that I'm particularly interested in. I've come to see the show twice, and I must say that I've spent as much time in the foyer watching the videos as I have engaging and looking at the work. I think if all of you have got the chance to sit down and look at the videos, it's well worth doing. I'm really interested in how other artists use materials and the processes other artists use. I think that his practice is remarkable in that the figures are modelled. So it's quite a simple process, not too different from modelling a small work, but at this scale it becomes much more complex. The forms take shape from small maquettes and models that he uses to get the pose and the posture right. Then small details and studies and things like the face, so that it's animated, or the relationship between the viewer and the object is how he wants. An armature is made from wire, and this is a process that is used, that a lot of sculptors use when they're either modelling or casting works. The armature is made from wire, and with larger works like this, and in the video for the pregnant woman, from large metal scaffolding poles. That's then wrapped in chicken mesh, so it fleshes out and fills out the form. Then plaster bandage to sort of smooth the surface a bit, and then the painstaking, meticulous work that must take hours, months, days.
Weeks.
The clay is built up. And then the detail drawn into, the clay is washed over with a damp sponge and then drawn into with a paintbrush. And that for me was really fascinating, to see the level of detail, the attention to detail that is so evident in the forms. In my own practice, I use casting processes, so I'm interested in the way he's been made a mould out of silicon, and a light painting on of silicon, and then a fiberglass mould that just reinforces it and gives it strength. For something like this, then a wooden scaffold needs to be made to support the fiberglass mould. So it is a complicated process, and I was really interested in the delicacy of some of the detail in the forms, but the roughness of the studio process, the sort of grimy studio space, and the way he's got a big wooden wedge and a big hammer to sort of release the mould from the cast. And I can understand that frustration. In one of the stop-motion videos, they're sort of wrenching, there's a whole group of assistants wrenching the fiberglass mould away from the cast. If they destroy the mould, they can't then make another sculpture, and most of them come in editions of 4 or 5. In the end, they actually have to hacksaw part of the fiberglass off. So I was really fascinated with that process, the level of detail, the testing and experimentation that he then does to get the skin right, to get the hair right, to get the sculptures looking like they do.
So should we? We're going to move on now to our kind of dialogue part. Because guess what? Nor Louise nor I like that sculpture. That's unfortunate, isn't it? They've asked us, and here we are not liking it. So we feel a bit bad about it. But I think for me, one of the main issues is that I'm ill at ease when I'm next to those sculptures. And I think it's intentional, but I'm ill at ease, and I don't enjoy that. And you know, I'm a 19th century person. I like pretty pictures. So I'm impressed, I'm a little scared, and I'm also a little disgusted, because, you see, they're not nude, they're naked, and there is something about it that's a big, and because there is this this lack of frontier, if you want, between the art and the actual roughness of the body, there is for me something that puts me right away in that ease. And it's definitely part of this feeling comes from the hyperrealism of the sculpture, and of course the size of them. I think if they were small little things, I could handle them better. Actually, I quite like the two little old ladies over there that are, you know, chatting, because there is something comfortable about the artificiality of them. Whereas here, somehow, I'm not at ease. So how does it work? For me, there's a web of relationship that's created right away between the immobile body and death. So for me, there is a very strong feeling about those bodies, those unanimated bodies, being dead body, being, you know, stricken by, you know, some bolt of lightning or something, and they've just been standing there. And there's also, of course, in the back of my mind, the myth of Pygmalion, you see. I think they might just get up and leave at some point. And so there is definitely something that really puts me at ease. So as I was saying earlier, the distance between art and life is actually is actually failing me here, because I'm drawn to believe they're there, but at the same time, the size of them convince me that they're not actual persons. So I can't really relate with them on an emotional level, because I can't create that human link with that giant. I don't manage, I don't, maybe you do, that's great, but I don't manage to actually engage with him on that emotional level that I would, for example, with a Rodin sculpture or with Carpo. And there is also to me something very medical about the way he looks at the human body. He's not picking up the best bits or anything. He's not trying to represent a deep emotion. He's just presenting a body as it is. And to me, there is something about it that turns it into that turns my eye into a medical eye. So I feel quite ready to take a scalpel and actually go and check out all the techniques that he was talking about. You see, I have this urge to actually, you know, become the doctor here somehow. I don't know, that playing doctor with a naked man, I'm not sure that's, you know, exactly what we're in for tonight. But so you see, I'm drawn in by the artificial emotion, but I'm conscious of its artificiality because of the play with size. So that means that I'm not able to distance myself from this emotion, but I know I'm being fooled. So there is something about it that really makes me uncomfortable. So how does the sculpture make you feel?
Actually, quite similarly. And I think it's because the distance that is created in the relationship between the viewer and the sculpture, because of its size, and also for me because of its materiality. I was conscious when I came and had a look at the show on Sunday that I was going to talk about it, and I felt I really want to be able to find this empathy with the figure, this humanity in the figure that has been talked about in other essays and texts about the work, but was unable to do it. And again, I want to go back to the technique. It was that I kept coming back to. There's a quote from Ron Muick. He doesn't often give interviews, so I think it's quite rare to actually find something something that he has said about the work, and he stated quite simply, the artist makes something to react to, the viewer reacts. People are going to respond in a different way to a figurative sculpture than they would to something abstract. There might be a certain degree of identification or empathy. They might go with that impulse or resist it and remain objective or analytical, or have an entirely different reaction, regardless if anyone thinks they're supposed to experience. So I did come here thinking, there is a way you're supposed to experience these works, and maybe there's something wrong with me and my response to the work. But that, you know, that's not the case. My response to the work is analytical, and it is on the technical virtuosity of the work, and my response and empathy is more with the artist as a craftsperson. And again, going back to the video, in understanding the process and the materials. And I think another thing that for me creates that distance between the work and myself, that kind of closes down that emotional response to the work, is my understanding of these materials and the way they operate. But that's something that you can experience as well. There's a fleshiness about this work when you first see it. You want to touch it. And when you first go through the exhibition, there's a panel on the wall with a piece of the plastic. If you touch that, it's not fleshy at all. It feels like plastic. So for me, that also sort of operates as a barrier to a more sort of emotional response to the work. And I'm interested in your response to the work as well, if anyone has anything that they want to say. Yes.
It's very interesting you mentioned the medical effect on you. Both my wife and I are physicians, and not just this character, but all of the characters, most of them anyway, are a reflection and a very accurate representation of literally thousands of people that we have seen over four decades of medical practice, from birth to death and everything in between. So because your medical training inures you to a degree to the variations and size and so on, there's no fear, and you can relate to what you're seeing. This is somebody that I knew. I saw somebody that looked just like this. And it's coincident with the time that I happened to be reading a book on human evolution and the juxtaposition of the displays and reading the book are very profound.
That's the interesting point. Do you want to talk a bit more about it, or do you want me to?
No, you can go on.
Well, what I'm going to look at now is try and see how it fits in terms of art history. You know that in art history, there is a deep relationship between the concept of beauty and the concept of the human body. Most of the time, when you want to represent beauty, you take a beautiful woman, a beautiful man, or actually you take bits and pieces of the most beautiful bits and pieces of beautiful men and women, and you construct that ideal beauty. And art actually shifts from this most perfect body, this kind of composite that you see during a period like neoclassicism, to the most realistic body in the 19th century. So you go from something like David's beautiful sculptural male to something like Courbet's The Origin of the World, which is of course a close-up of a vagina, so something quite different. And that's part of this evolution, where you actually start looking at the human body in a different way and trying to represent it, to make it as real as possible. But I think that with Wormwick, you go into something that's even more real than real, if you like. And the movement he belongs to is called hyperrealism. So what's the difference between realism and hyperrealism? That's always, fine lines. Well, hyperrealism really originated in the US in the mid-60s. And it's actually an offshoot of pop art. And I think if you think of it in the context of pop art, in the context of those cans, if you like, it unlocks something for those sculptures. They were attacked at the time as betraying the modernist principles, because of course it was at the time reactionary to return to representational illusionism. You really had this sense that you were failing modernism somehow. And as you know, also with pop art, there is this rejection of elitism. There is this cool and detached approach to everything. So there is this kind of mood, if you want, that we can find in those work. And with pop art, of course, there is this work on the trompe-l'œil. It's not new. It's not something that the 20th century invented. In the 17th century, the Dutch painter were already doing it. If you can go even further back than that, the 19th century academic painting, you have some very elaborate trompe-l'œil that were created. But I think one of the effect of that hyperrealism is that it tends to dehumanize those bodies and to actually comment, if you want, on the society that surrounds them and create those kind of sort of social observation, if you want. When I first approached those works, I thought, like, what kind of theoretical framework can I use to look at them and actually engage with them? And the thing that popped in my mind, God knows why, was Kristeva and the theory of the abject, which is interesting because her whole theory is about exactly about dead bodies. So you see that I'm going back to that first impression that there's something wrong with those people. So she defines them in opposition to the object of desire that Lacan has been working on. To me that's been one of the frameworks which I've approached them. But I think you had a quite a different take on them.
I guess in relation to more contemporary sculptural practice and the notion of the abject had some currency in contemporary practice in the early 90s, and I'm thinking about artists like Paul McCarthy, Mike Kelly, Kiki Smith and Louise Bourgeois. The abject is something existing between the subject and the object, something that is alien and intimate and exposes the fragility of our own boundaries and distinctions between outside and inside. So often those works are really visceral and depicted blood and shit, the kind of things that you're not supposed to see or talk about or apprehend in a sculptural work. So I think in relation to the abject and my understanding of the abject in contemporary sculptural practice, they sort of have a distance and a sterile medical quality that I sort of don't sort of think of the abject in relation to these sculptures.
we were having a discussion yesterday about whether they are actually ironic sculptures. And we were wondering to what level, to what degree. And that's completely a question that's for you to, you know, explore. Look around them. Because one of his first work was Pinocchio. And if you've seen that work, it's definitely an ironic work. It's something that wants the viewer to laugh. So I was wondering to what level those sculptures that we see here today have an ironic side to them, and how you could actually also look at them with that ironic look. But I think it's time for us to stop. Thank you.